Two Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Thank you for joining us again tonight as we come to you live from, well, actually recorded. I mean, we're live, but you're hearing it recorded from Washington, D.C., not that far from the Supreme Court building, as the Supreme Court hears a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. It is about 7 past the hour. Our first guest today is, or tonight is Jackie Speier. She's a Democrat from California's 12th District. That's the district that she represents. She is an advocate for women in the House floor. She has gone to the floor of the House many times to tell stories of men and women, our armed forces, who have been raped or sexually assaulted while in the line of duty. Her past includes the horrific events around the Jonestown massacre, suicide massacre, back in 1978 when she was a staff member to then Congressman Leo Ryan. Jackie was one of the people who should have been dead. She was shot 5 times. She survived. And while others around her, 6 other people were killed in that horrific event, she went on to become a fighter for her constituents back home and for just about everything else that she's dealt with in her life. Jackie, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks,
let
Mike.
Let me just start with a general question of how the Affordable Care Act has the biggest impact on women.
It has a huge impact on women. What we don't realize that in the individual market, 93% of the plans are gender rated, which means women pay more than men. Now, it's $1 billion more per year that women are paying in premiums. Now, some might say, well, wait a minute. I mean, they have reproductive health. They have they give birth to children, so that should be included.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. The fact of the matter is these plans in the individual market don't cover maternity care. So that is excluded, and yet still women are paying anywhere from 30% more in premiums to 80% more in premiums in the same state with similar plans. A 40-year-old woman who is a non-smoker is paying more for health care than a 40-year-old man who is a smoker in most states in the country.
How does the Affordable Care Act address that?
So the Affordable Care Act bans gender discrimination. Now, some states have already taken action. California is one of them.
Right.
I carried the legislation back a number of years ago. But 9 states prevent gender discrimination, and some states require maternity care, California being another one. But the Affordable Care Act will provide that no longer can you gender rate, no longer can you charge women more for health care than you do men based on a similar policy and similar provisions.
Why do women on the political right not understand that important aspect of the ACA to the extent that they are not in front of the Supreme Court this morning with the signs and placards saying, I want my freedom? I can't get my mind around that.
You know, I think it's one of those dirty little secrets that we don't really, doesn't register, that there is gender discrimination in the pricing of health insurance unrelated to reproductive health. And I think that if more women were aware of this, they would be pretty outraged.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we want to be discriminated against? I think on the far right, it is less about health care and more about trying to defeat President Obama. This is really trying to, you know, win the presidency more than it is.
But what a price. To put people, women, children, men, to put health care and health in general at risk for a political idea, this makes no sense to me. But
and in fairness, I would say that we didn't do a good job of messaging
right.
what was in the law.
Well, part of that, I think, also is because of this incredibly inept or negative media that we all have to deal with. I mean, all of us deal with how we get our news and what is reported on the evening news or on the cable channels that go on seemingly endlessly. And that, I think, has been a major failure of getting the message out.
Right. I mean, remember the whole debate about death panels? There was never anything in there about death panels.
I remember.
It stuck.
Right.
And we didn't respond quickly enough and effectively enough. The fact that there were so many myths associated with it was going to provide health care to undocumented residents. It has nothing to do with providing health care to undocumented people. It's actually going to save money, not cost money in the long run. But none of that really got full airing. And then this issue around gender discrimination is really a huge issue when you realize that a woman is going to be paying so much more for health care over the course of her life for no reason other than they decided to just charge women more, these insurers.
Mm-hmm. What, at the risk of sounding like we're trying to predict the future here, what do you see as the probability or possibility the Supreme Court's going to rule either way? Now, I realize the only aspect of ACA that's up is the mandate. But there's also been arguments made that if the mandate goes, the rest of it has to go. An argument, the mandate goes, okay, we'll stick with the other parts. This is a real mess. And given the nature of the political nature of the Supreme Court, I've asked several guests over the past day or so, what do you think is going to happen? Let me ask you the same thing.
Well, if the individual mandate was held to be unconstitutional, which I believe will not happen, but if it were, then the actuarial soundness of the health care plan falls flat because you cannot provide the kinds of benefits that we have in the system, whether it's keeping your young adult child on your health plan, whether it's preventing pre-existing conditions from being taken into consideration, the benefit to senior citizens where they're saving about $600 a year in prescription drugs in the donut hole right now. All those benefits, the well screenings. Right now, you don't pay a copay. If you go in for a mammogram or a colonoscopy, no more copays. That's a huge benefit to all of us, you know, $100, $200 in a typical copay.
Sure.
So all of that goes away because you can't fund health care if you don't have the risk spread wide enough so that healthy people are in the pool along with people who are chronically ill.
We have about 2 minutes left here. Why was it not presented, this Affordable Care Act, presented with the public option, A, or B, why not presented as a single-payer plan like so many so-called industrialized countries have?
So, very good question. If we could roll back the tape, we should have messaged this as Medicare for All.
Right.
And either created the public option or extended Medicare to every American. I mean, when people realize we're the only industrialized country in the world that does not provide health care for everyone, and we're paying so much for it, and we're not getting benefits that suggest that we have better health care. In fact, just the reverse. 18% of our GDP is going to health care. I mean, that's an incredible, incredible cost that we're paying. And the numbers just keep going up. So we have to rein in the costs. And in every country that's industrialized that has a universal health care program in place, they're spending less
than we are,
GDP,
sure.
And their results in terms of quality are better.
So the only answer to that question is maybe it wasn't presented, not maybe, but certainly it wasn't presented in a way that would have done a couple of things. First of all, to let all Americans know what this was and how important it was. And secondly, to short-circuit any kind of false interpretation, or I might as well say it, lies that put out there by the right wing about what this consisted of. The only good thing I can see, and I really don't want to say this, but I'll say it anyway, the only good thing I can see if this is defeated or ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court would be a requirement then to start over again, and maybe if we started over again, we could work more to educate the American people. Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mike,
for
nice
being here. I appreciate it very much. Sorry for the false start.
That's all right.
But thanks a lot. Take care.
All right.
Our guest has been Jackie Spear. She is a congressperson from California's 12th district. And we'll return shortly, right after these commercial announcements, with more from Washington from the Supreme Court. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
All right.
Welcome back. There goes bells ringing and horns going off and so on and so forth. Welcome back to our broadcast from near the Supreme Court building as the Supreme Court listens to arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act and whether or not the mandate part of it is unconstitutional. Our guest now is Jeff List. He is a partner in Anzalone List Research, a nationally recognized Democratic polling firm. And along with his partner, John Anzalone, Jeff polled for the 2008 Obama presidential campaign in seven states. One of the issues, Jeff, that I can't get my mind around is the while the polling favors some sort of health care available to all Americans, people are very, very confused about what the Affordable Care Act consists of. How do you explain that?
Well, I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out what the Affordable Care Act is going to mean for them. I think that's part of the reason why you've got support for a lot of the provisions of the law, like requiring insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions, but not necessarily support for the law overall. I also think that the numbers on the law overall are tied up in a lot of the misinformation from Republicans about the process by which it was passed. And I think that there hasn't been a correction of that misinformation because, you know, a lot of the provisions are coming online over the next couple of years. And as people get more experience with the law and get to touch and feel some of the benefits, I think you're going to see the numbers on it improve.
How do the people developing health care for Americans, how do you overcome, first of all, a media that persists in not being honest about this, and a political force that is determined to use this as a way of bringing down the President of the United States? How do you overcome that?
Right. Well, look, I think that if you're watching Fox News, you're getting a lot of information about the Affordable Care Act, and most of it is negative. If you're watching real news, then, you know, you're not hearing that much about the Affordable Care Act. And in that respect, I think that these oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court are a good thing, because there's going to be more discussion, more people are going to hear about the benefits of the law. Again, people are still trying to figure out what this means for them, and there's a lot of confusion in healthcare right now about what's law, what isn't law, what's in the Affordable Care Act, what's the Ryan budget. And I think that the campaign this fall is also going to help sharpen that. I think you're going to see discussion not only of the Affordable Care Act and how Republicans want to go back to the days when insurance companies could deny people coverage if they had pre-existing conditions, but you're also going to see that tied in with the discussion of the Ryan plan to privatize Medicare and end the program as we know it.
Will that make a difference, do you think, when we get into the final stage of this presidential campaign and Romney or whoever challenges and the ludicrousness of Romney challenging the ACA is just beyond belief to me after what was put into effect in Massachusetts. But do you think that if it's Romney and Obama, whoever it is, do you think in the discussion, in the debates or the challenges, that the truth is going to come out here?
I do. I mean, I think that obviously having more of these provisions come online is going to help with that as well. But you've got a lot of Republicans who are running away from what were consensus Republican positions 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to have a debate about the Affordable Care Act, because right now, perceptions of the law tend to be pretty closely tied to partisanship. Mm-hmm. You know, support for the law is a proxy for partisanship. Democrats like it, Republicans don't. Mm-hmm. Independents are divided fairly equally. And, you know, that again speaks to the lack of information about what's in the law. You know, and again, I think the debate is going to help correct some of that.
Well, I hope you're right. Again, the first of all, I think the Democrats could have done a lot better job of packaging this and presenting it to the American public. But having said that, I think the media, the obligation to me of the media would have been to sort through it and let people know that, no, there's no such thing as a death panel. No, there's no such thing as this. No, these people are lying to you. But in so many cases, everything in this country right now is so politicized, it's ridiculous. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us. I hope we'll have a chance to talk when the campaign gets going, because I'd love to hear what your polling firm is coming up with.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, sir. Take care. All right, we have a break coming here. We will be back momentarily, and we'll continue with our guests from Washington, D.C., as the Affordable Care Act is being presented to a very, very conservative Supreme Court. We shall keep you posted on what's going on. All right, stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Wendell Potter, he's an author and leading critic of the health insurance industry. He served since May of 2009 as the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He also had a 20-year career as a corporate public relations executive, and last year left his job as head of communications for one of the nation's largest health insurers to try his hand at helping socially responsible organizations, including those advocating for meaningful health care reform, help them achieve their goals. Wendell, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Center for Media and Democracy, how does that tie into what is occurring at the Supreme Court across the street today?
Well, the Center for Media and Democracy is an organization that works to try to expose the corrosive effects of corporate public relations and government public relations that are not in the best interest of U.S. citizens or American citizens. Mm-hmm. And I used to hate the organization when I was in the PR business, because they do an exceptionally good job of disclosing spin and providing information about who is behind certain propaganda. I'm now also with the Center for Public Integrity, which is a Washington-based organization that does investigative reporting. And
it's a great organization.
It
by
is,
the way.
And I write analysis pieces on healthcare and healthcare reform.
What is it about our system that seems to be so resistant to the idea of, if not universal health care, which I support, a single payer plan, but so resistant to the idea that there should be health care available for everyone, and that it just like auto insurance in the States, it does require everybody has to participate in order for everybody to benefit. Why is there so much resistance to this?
Well, because the special interests are so powerful and have been able to influence people's thinking over many years, and it's clearly been behind the poll results that we've been seeing that Americans don't support the Affordable Care Act. The main thing that they seem to dislike most is what the Supreme Court is dealing with today, and that's the requirement that all of us have to buy coverage. It's kind of regrettable that the Affordable Care Act had to be written the way it was, but the health insurance industry is so powerful and influential in this city that it had to be constructed around the existing system of health insurance. Mm-hmm. Most of the other countries in the developed world don't have a system like ours that allows for-profit insurance companies to control their health care system like ours does. And no other system in the world has citizens going bankrupt when they can't afford coverage, or that allows insurers to exclude people from coverage because they've been sick in the past. But our system is all that most Americans know. They don't really understand that it can be done better. And they've just been told that anything that's other than ours is some kind of socialistic system.
The what's lacking, obviously, and I think anyone would agree with this, is education of the American public. We do have some screwy ideas sometimes that seem to be caught up in the idea of individualism. There's nothing wrong with being an individual, but if you're going to be part of a society of 330 million people, there also has to be some cooperation. I mean, whether it's paying our taxes, whether it's defending the country, whether it's working here at home to clean up the environment, no matter what it is, there's got to be cooperation. Why, and that cooperation, I think, could have been explained by, this is going to sound goofy, by the insurance industry, but why shouldn't they if they're being handed 35 million new subscribers? Why? Which is what the Affordable Care Act does. It just says, here, insurance company, here's 35 million new customers. Now, help us help them understand why we're doing this. Why didn't the insurance industry do that?
Well, because it's not in their best interest to try to get in this fight at this stage. Because I think they believe, as I do, that the law will be upheld, that it will be declared constitutional, and that it will go forward, and Americans will be required to buy coverage from them if they're not eligible already for Medicare or Medicaid. But what they want, their real objective here is not to have this law declared unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. What their real objective is to try to get more people who like them, who are more sympathetic to the views of for-profit insurance companies, to be members of Congress, and to try to replace Barack Obama with someone who is more likely to go along with their points of view. Mm-hmm. The worst case scenario for Americans is for the court to uphold the constitutionality of this law, and then Americans to be persuaded to elect more people to Congress who will be allies of the insurance industry, because their real objective is to have lawmakers strip out the consumer protections that are in the law. Mm-hmm. So the worst case scenario for Americans is for the law to be upheld and for more friends of the industry to be in Congress in positions of power to strip out the protections that are the main reason for this law.
So it's important here then, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's important for the Supreme Court to rule a certain way, but it's also important for the American people to understand that in order to get the ACA in play and then perhaps move forward, that there's going to have to be elections where people are sent to Congress who understand that the best interest of the American people, not the best interest of the insurance industry, should be served.
Right. That's exactly right.
Now, how does one educate people into believing that. Do you think if the Supreme Court rules, no, this is constitutional, that that can be accomplished? Getting people into Congress who will support this decision and go on in making it even stronger for health care?
We will have one heck of a battle this fall for public office, regardless of which way the Supreme Court goes. If it's declared unconstitutional, then I think that there will be one kind of debate. If it's declared, if it's upheld, there will be a different kind of debate. If it's upheld, I think that the folks who are out here picketing against the Affordable Care Act will be revved up to try to throw out the people in Congress who voted for it in the first place. So it's going to be a real struggle. And it's more challenging to explain the merits of legislation than it is to denounce it with a soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been going on. We've seen the ability of the special interests to condemn this legislation for their own political purposes by calling it a government takeover of health care, which of course it's not. Or to say that it creates death panels, which it does not do. But that's all part of the strategy to try to get people to think and vote against their own self-interest.
And to a large extent, it seems to be working to convince people that a continuation of what we've had, this kind of patchwork quilt system of insurance provision, to continue that with the cost of care or surgical procedures or diagnostic tests, all of this stuff going off the chart, and while at the same time the weakening of the middle class, decline in real wages, it would just seem to me that people would have one of these aha moments where they would say, well, this is insane not to support this. This is a part, Wendell, it just makes me crazy. I mean, I cannot get my mind around that.
It makes me crazy, too. But part of the reason, and one reason why it makes me crazy, is that largely our media has not provided adequate information. And our population, in many cases, kind of outsources its thinking, or we outsource our thinking to people who we trust but who are not really trustworthy. So consequently, we don't get the kinds of information. People don't know what they should know about our healthcare system and the fact that it's so dysfunctional, and that all of us in this country are just a layoff away from being uninsured and what the consequences of that are, and that we pay so much for health care and health insurance in this country that it's robbing us of health, of pay increases. Per capita income on a median basis, the household income, has actually been declining in recent years when you account for inflation. And part of the reason for that is because of the ever-escalating cost of health care and health insurance premiums. But people don't know that.
Well, I hope that, first of all, I hope the Supreme Court rules in favor of the constitutionality of this act. There certainly is precedent to lead them in that direction, although the makeup of this court is suspect to me. It's so far right. But we shall see, as my grandmother used to say, we shall see what we shall see. And I just hope that some right decisions are made. Wendell Potter from the Center for Media and Democracy, thank you very much for being here.
Mike, thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back momentarily with more from Washington, D.C., from near the Supreme Court. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. the world that 10 before the hour, and this hour has been sponsored by Sam Evans, who writes, this time last year I was deployed to Afghanistan. Podcasts of your show helped me get through that difficult time. The sponsorship is my way of saying thanks for speaking the truth, and I encourage all Malloy listeners tonight to purchase a podcast subscription to sponsor an hour or sponsor an hour of the program. If he goes off the air, you will regret not having done your part to support the show. Amen. Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it. Our guest now is Dr. George Benjamin. He has been the executive director of the American Public Health Association, which is the nation's oldest and largest organization of public health professionals. He came to that post from his position as secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. He also became secretary of health in Maryland in April 1999 and oversaw an expansion and improvement in that state's Medicaid program. Medicaid is not getting a lot of attention in this particular issue, especially what's going on in front of the Supreme Court right now. But Medicaid is an important component of the Affordable Care Act, is it not?
It's a major part of this, which is not really getting the attention it deserves at all.
What is necessary for people to know about the Affordable Care Act vis-a-vis Medicaid?
Well, you know, there is an assumption in this country that Medicaid covers all poor people. Well, it didn't until the Affordable Care Act, and now it does. And that's, you know, the state, while there are many states that are arguing that we shouldn't do that, think about what we've really done. I mean, one of the major contributions of this law, one of the major accomplishments of this law is, in essence, to make sure that every person who's low income in this country is now eligible to be into the Medicaid program. That's a major accomplishment and important if we're seriously going to try to move to a healthy society.
You know, Dr. Benjamin, I have asked most of the guests that I've talked to in the past day and a half the same question. Why the resistance to health care for all Americans regardless of income? Why this resistance?
Hey, listen, you know, we've had this debate before. We had this debate for Social Security when we were talking about seniors and poor people. You know, there's a belief that we should all pick ourselves up from our bootstraps and a lack of understanding that the only way we pick ourselves up, certainly we should help ourselves, but with help from others, whether it's our neighbors, our family, our friends. And what this law really does is it basically reorganizes the market and creates a very strong social safety net in our country. It's greatly needed, and we're glad that the law got passed 2 years ago.
You know, pulling oneself up by the bootstraps is a little bit difficult if you don't have boots to begin with. And it just seems to me that, all right, let me put it this way. I hear an awful lot of politicians on the right talking about pushing the issue about this being a Christian nation founded on Christian principles. The way I have read the Bible is that there was very strict directives from the carpenter 2,000 years ago to take care of the sick, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and now we're in a period where professed Christians are out here trying to do just the opposite by short-circuiting this Affordable Care Act. How does that disconnect happen?
There's a huge disconnect there, and the fact of the matter is this law does exactly that. It makes sure that we're taking care of our neighbors. It makes sure that we are sharing for those of us who are financially able to share, and it makes sure that everybody adds their fair share to the as part of the collective. It is a decidedly American piece of legislation. There's no question that when this law was passed, that this was decidedly an American way to do it. Otherwise, we would have done it the way they've done it in other countries. This is clearly, in many ways, unfortunate.
Amen.
Because it's so complicated.
Right.
But that's the way we do things in our country, and the law should stand.
I hate to drag religion into it, but every single Republican candidate for public office seems to drag religion into these political debates, and I think I don't think that's a good idea. I remember my grandmother, when she taught me about religion, she made it very clear that the public sphere was not necessarily where religion belongs, certainly not in politics, because it would corrupt both. So I hate to see these right wingers bring it up, but since they have brought it up, then I think it has to be discussed that they are not following the admonitions of their own religious principles. Let me ask you this: we got about 2 minutes here. The arguments going on in front of the Supreme Court right now are being argued in front of a court that is decidedly right-wing. There's no argument about that. What do you see as the chances that this challenge to the mandate will, the Supreme Court will say, no, we're going to rule it constitutional, or, you know, it's not constitutional?
I think at the end of the day, when the court looks at precedent, particularly meaning of their own decisions in the past, that this court will rule that this law is constitutional, including the individual mandate.
You know, most of the people that I have talked with have pretty much said the same thing. But most of the people I've talked with in the past day and a half are in favor of the act to begin with. We don't know what this Supreme Court has got a reputation all of a sudden of doing things, legislating from the bench, I think is the way the right-wingers put it. I have to tell you, I'm a little bit nervous about it, Dr. Benjamin.
Well, we're all nervous because you never know what the court will do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in this case, I think precedent is there. I'm not an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, talking with my attorney friends,
mm-hmm.
I believe precedent is there, and I think history is there, and I think the health and well-being of the American people is clearly ought to be and is their first, you know, priority, and I think this court will do the right thing.
I hope you're right. Dr. George Benjamin, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Mike.
All
enjoy
right,
being
sir.
Here.
Take
All
care.
Right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back, Truth Seekers. Stay with us. More from Washington, from the Supreme Court. I'm Mike Malloy. Think of this. So we have some past the hour, and once again, if you're just joining us, we are coming to you from near the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., recording the program for broadcast as you're hearing it. We are here this morning, Tuesday morning, with all the protesters and all the people who are in favor of the Affordable Care Act. This hour, by the way, is being sponsored by Janie Aguilar. Her message is, let's put unity back into community. Thank you, Janie. Joining us now is Jennifer Nandu. Right? I got it right,
you
Jennifer?
You got it right.
Thank you. She's a deputy director of the Health Policy Project for the National Council of La Raza, the largest national Hispanic civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Jennifer, how does this impact the Hispanic community? And before you answer, there is such an anti-Hispanic attitude out there, in my perception anyway. It comes under many guises, anti-so-called illegal immigrant, anti-undocumented worker, anti. How does the Affordable Care Act impact, then, the Hispanic community?
Well, I like how you started this with your words of response, or let's bring back the unity and community. That's an important part of this discussion because Latinos are intimately tied to the future of this country. They are the fastest and largest growing community in the United States, and I think with this community, because there are new immigrants within the community, not all Latinos are immigrants, but there are new immigrants in this community, and many people are the children of immigrants. There's a lot of fear about what comes next, but we really have to invest in their health if we're going to invest in the health of this country. Latinos are one of the most uninsured communities in the country, 1 in 3 uninsured in this country. And that's not because they're not going out and buying insurance. Latinos are the most likely to work in this country, but less likely to receive an offer of insurance through their employer. And so the Affordable Care Act opens up those new options. So in 2014, you're going to see many things come down the pipeline that allow them to pay their fair share and get access to affordable health coverage.
Is there a consensus in the Latino community about, in this instance, the Affordable Care Act, the idea, I guess what I'm trying to get to, the larger, the dominant community, the dominant culture in this country is displaying an awful lot of ignorance about what the ACA is about. How do people who are new to this country and maybe don't even speak the language or use it as a second language, how do they perceive this?
Well, Latinos who have both been in this country for a long time and who are new, for the most part, when they learn about the benefits of the Affordable Care Act, they're much more likely to support it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually one of the problems with the conversation about the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot of misinformation. There are a lot of misperceptions about what it does. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, this act is 2 years old. It's just a baby, and there's benefits coming into the community. For instance, let me give you for example, nearly 750,000 young Latino adults under the age of 26 have been able to get on their parents' health care plans because of the Affordable Care Act. There are 72 new preventive services that Latinos and anybody who has an insurance plan no longer have to pay for out of their own pockets. No co-pays, no co-insurance because of rules under the Affordable Care Act. That's the untold story, and it's counterbalanced with misinformation and misperceptions about the law.
Is there, in your opinion, Jennifer, is there a bias that plays in here, a racist kind of bias against people of color who also happen to be Spanish speakers that shows itself in resistance to ACA?
Well, here's what I'd say. I think there's a lot of, as you noted, there's a lot of misperceptions about the law, and one of those things is that people of color may be using the system more than others. That's just not the case. And unfortunately, their disconnection from the healthcare system means that they often don't gain access to the affordable health insurance that they need in order to be healthy. And so we're here to clear it up, but also to say that, hey, Latinos and other people of color really want to pay their fair share, share in the responsibility of strengthening our healthcare system. And part of that is being able to make sure that we shape this new law as it's implemented, as it's carried out in the states, and make sure that the benefits reach every single community who needs it, not just Latinos or other people of color.
Does your organization advocate for single payer? Would that be the most effective way to deliver health care in this country? A single payer system that is not, regardless of what the right wing says, is not socialized medicine, but is the type of health care using the French or the Canadian model where people have access. You still have to pay in, but you have access, and you can't be turned down for these half-witted reasons in this country. Is that the attitude in your impression from the Latino community?
I think we have seen all the polls. We have went out there and talked to communities. We have 300 community-based organizations in our network. And the resounding answer about what people want in healthcare is they want healthcare for all. How they get there, it can be different ways.
Right.
Single payer is one of them, and it's one that a large number of Latinos support in this country, a large percentage of Latinos in this country support. So that's definitely something that we're in pursuit of. But what I'd say is this, that the Affordable Care Act is a step forward. It's not a perfect law, and no one has ever said it is, at least not at the National Council of La Raza. But we do believe that there's benefits out there that people are missing today, and that we have to protect the law in order to make sure that it fulfills what it can do in the future. So,
what would happen when if the Supreme Court upholds this, what happens to those so-called undocumented workers who are in this country when they need health care? Will this also provide that care for them, or is there yet another hurdle that they would have to go over?
Well, we just talked about this being an imperfect law, and this law does not provide coverage for everyone in this country.
Right.
So undocumented workers, people who are here, who do not have papers, are not afforded any of the benefits of the law. In fact, they can't even pay full price and get health coverage in the new marketplaces, which is something that we think if they want to pay their fair share, they ought to be able to pay in and get their own health insurance. But at the same time, it's important to note that while undocumented immigrants cannot, there are legal immigrants in this country, and there should be no misperceptions that anybody who is legally present, who does have their papers, can get the benefits of the law. And that's an important point because there's also lots of restrictions to health care today to legal immigrants. And then I'd also say that the legal family members of undocumented workers can get the benefits of the law. They're going to have to prove their status.
So this issue of universal health care, and we only have a few seconds left here, but this is also tied into, in the Latino community, the larger issue of how one becomes a documented or legal or accepted citizen in this country. It's tied together, isn't it?
And, what I'd say about that is there is we have an immigration system that's broken. It needs to be fixed. And that part of creating that new pathway to citizenship and fixing our immigration system and securing our borders and doing the comprehensive set of things we need to do to fix our immigration system, those things often keep people out of pathways to health insurance as well.
Yeah.
And you'd think they're very separate things. We ought to be encouraging everybody to pay their share and get into the health insurance system. But it's not a conversation about health. It's where somebody comes from.
I hear you loud and clear. Jennifer Nandu, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. We shall be back momentarily. Stick around. More conversation with our guests from near the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., while the ACA is being argued before the Supreme Court. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. Coming to you from Washington, D.C., from not far from the Supreme Court building, where the ACA is being argued in front of a decidedly conservative Supreme Court. Joining us now is Max Richmond. He's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He served at the National Committee since 1989, most recently as its executive vice president, acting CEO. He is also a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, and 16-year veteran of Capitol Hill. He now leads a national committee at a critical juncture in the history of Social Security and Medicare. This is something right up my alley, of course, since I now participate in part of that.
You could have fooled me.
I'm sorry?
You could have fooled me.
Oh, well, thank you. But how does the ACA tie into the disposition of Medicare?
Well, there are so many ways the Affordable Care Act improved the Medicare program,
mm-hmm.
And all that all those improvements disappear if mm-hmm. If the law is repealed or it is overturned by the courts. Anybody who's on Medicare or has followed the debate about Medicare the last few years knows about the donut hole,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the new prescription drug. Well, it's not so new. It was passed in 2003, a prescription drug benefit, Part D in Medicare,
mm-hmm.
that unfortunately has a gap in coverage. You know, usually insurance, you have a deductible at the beginning, you meet it, then you have coverage. This
right.
law... you're covered, and then you're not covered, and that gap is called the donut hole. And when you have extreme out-of-pocket expenses, then your coverage enters what they call the catastrophic phase. The Affordable Care Act closes the donut hole over a number of years, and in the meantime, it reduces costs until that to beneficiaries that fall into the donut hole until it is closed by discounts on many, many drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, 2011, the average Medicare beneficiary that fell into the donut hole because of the Affordable Care Act saved $700. That's real money.
Mm-hmm.
That would disappear.
Mm-hmm.
The Affordable Care Act added a lot of preventive benefits at no cost, no out-of-pocket cost to a Medicare beneficiary.
Diagnostic tests and...
A one-time-a-year wellness visit, a consultation.
Screening tests, then.
Screenings for mm-hmm. cancer. Diabetes, mammography, no cost, out of pocket. Mm-hmm. These preventive measures are more likely to be used if there is no out of pocket cost, and they will save money and, of course, mm-hmm. lives, pain, suffering over time. All that would disappear. So if you're a senior or will be a senior on Medicare and mm-hmm. care about the Medicare program, you've got a big investment. In making sure that the Affordable Care Act mm-hmm. Stays on the books.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that prescription benefit, so-called, was the result of the Bush administration, and we could sit here and talk about that at length as to the trickery involved in, first of all, an unfunded so-called unfunded mandate, but secondly, the fact that what you just pointed out, that so many people then fall into that situation, the so-called donut hole. There was no provision for negotiating with pharmaceutical companies to get the price down. It was a real giveaway. And I would imagine that there is an aftertaste with people about what a trick that was. Do you find that it is difficult to educate the people who are coming up to Medicare that the ACA is very important to them?
Absolutely. Well, two things. Now, you mentioned that there's no provision in the prescription drug benefit that was mm-hmm. added almost 10 years ago to Medicare for negotiating
right.
the best price. Not only is there no provision, there is a specific provision in that law that forbids Medicare from negotiating with the pharmaceutical companies. Now, does that make any sense when you have an entity representing tens of millions of people that can't negotiate with something they all need?
Mm-hmm.
Insane is being nice.
Yeah, right.
The Veterans Administration does have that authority,
mm-hmm.
so that's specifically prohibited. And you can, I'm sure, and your listeners can imagine who made sure that prohibition was written
sure.
into the law.
Sure.
The reason it's been hard up till now to raise the awareness about the benefits of the Affordable Care Act is the other side, the opponents of the Affordable Care Act, did a pretty darn good job over the last few years in demonizing the program as to how it affects seniors as well as other things.
Well, that's the point. And Max, we're flat out of time here. I would love to talk to you when we have more time. But that's the point, I think, that organizations that lobby on behalf of seniors, that's the point they're going to have to make.
Seniors have to understand the Affordable Care Act means they get more
that's right.
and pay less.
That's right.
Very straightforward.
Absolutely. Max Richmond, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
I'm sure we'll have a chance chance to talk, and we got more time than a quick 5 or 6 minutes. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. All right, we'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour, and again, this hour is being sponsored by Jane Aguilar, whose message is simply, let's put unity back into community. Thank you, Jane. Our guest, next guest, is Dr. Hugh Hill. Dr. Hill's worked in emergency rooms for 28 years, dealing with both insured and uninsured people who come through the door. If you're a physician, you don't ask them those kinds of questions. You just take care of them. The patients he sees on a daily basis have shaped his view on the politics of healthcare in the United States. He was at Bayview before entering government service with HHS, and while at the Centers for Medicine and Medical Services, he acted as director of the coverage and analysis group, which decides which new services and products Medicare will cover. He is currently the director of Fast Track, offering no appointment care for the less severely ill and injured. Dr. Hill, where it concerns Medicare and Medicaid, and I asked someone who was on just a few minutes ago, how important is ACA to the disbursement of Medicare and Medicaid funds? How important?
Incredibly important. We are, one of the things that I think people don't understand is that in the emergency department, we are redistributing costs in perhaps an irrational way. So I hope you don't have to come to see me, but if you do, you're going to be charged about 5 times more than what you should be. That's my own estimate. When we're only collecting 20 or 30% of what we bill, we've got to cover our cost, keep right. The equipment running and the lights on, by charging everybody more so that when somebody does come along that's paying full rate, we can collect it. So the Affordable Care Act rationalizes that in a way by distributing it out. Emergency care is kind of like a fire department or the police. Mm-hmm. You hope you don't need them, but you want them to be there. And so they are, in a sense, a public good. And having the emergency room available to you is the same sort of thing. Now, so far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned, we really are the bottom rung on the safety net. When somebody can't get help anywhere else, they come to see us. Tragedy of it is they come too late. Somebody that could have been helped, maybe even saved, by an earlier, less expensive intervention winds up in the emergency department, and that's tragic when that happens. Mm-hmm. So my organization, the American College of Emergency Physicians, strongly supports the Affordable Care Act because of its expansion of Medicaid coverage and the opportunity to get more people covered with health care and hope that they can get treated and not have to come to mm-hmm. see us.
Given the fact that we have public health care in this country on an emergency basis, regardless of the politics involved in the ACA, and we share this cost, everybody shares this cost, the emergency room situation where a person comes in who's uninsured but is still going to be treated. Given that reality, why is it so difficult to convince people of a certain political persuasion in this country that we're already doing it, let's do it more efficiently?
I'm a follow-the-money guy, Warren. I think that's because some of the people that aren't convinced find it to be in their best interest financially. And unfortunately, they've been able to, by application of those dollars, convince some other folks to vote and agitate against their own interests by suggesting that for principles or other reasons, they should oppose the Affordable Care Act. And so here, if we had an educated, informed public, I think we'd have even stronger support for the Affordable Care Act than we do.
Well, an educated and informed public means having media that are responsible in getting the truth out where it concerns what this is about. Let me ask you this, though. I am a strong advocate for single-payer health care as kind of a halfway measure. It was my understanding that the president was going to push for public option. And, of course, neither of those things wound up as part of the ACA. It would have been named a different, entitled a different way had it been. But what is your position on single-payer, more in the Canadian or the French model, not in the British model? I'm not talking about socialized medicine, but I'm talking about single-payer health care, where physician services and physician selection is handled individually, but we all contribute to a pool that's paid for by the government.
Organized medicine and individual doctors' thinking about that has evolved. You know, this is the 100-year anniversary of the first effort by the federal government to do some health care reform and health care benefits for...
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt first proposed something back in 1912. And over the years, organized medicine has been dragged kicking and screaming into the government's involvement in medicine, having opposed Medicare, having opposed Social Security, all along the way. And the somewhat ironic thing about that is that now doctors are beginning to realize that what insurance companies are doing to them and their patients is worse than their fears about what the federal government could do. So my organization, Emergency Physicians, probably about two-thirds of our members now favor single-payer. The internists voted back in the 1990s to be in favor of single-payer. And for some people, it's a sort of giving up on an old model. For others, it's a recognition that they can better take care of patients in that sort of a structure.
Do you see, given the resistance that has come in the past from the medical community, and what you just pointed out, given the reality now that I think a lot of physicians and groups of physicians see what the insurance companies are doing, do you foresee a time when medical associations and individual doctors will actually advocate for or push for single payer?
It's entirely possible. I think we've got an intermediate step here with these accountable care organizations that is a part of the Affordable Care Act, because they are going to be, in a sense, guarantors of people's health. Their profits will be greater if they can keep people healthy and if they can provide high-quality care cheaper. So we're moving in that direction piecemeal. And for some folks, this is an intermediate step towards single payer. For others, it's such a massive favorable change that they support it on its own, even without looking to that future.
Given the testimony before congressional committees prior to the writing of this act, was it noticeable to you the types of people who were not invited to testify? In other words, the people who were invited to testify did not include folks who were in favor of single-payer. Do you think the American public was given a fair representation of what could be done by not having those people testify?
This may not be directly responsive. I don't remember the list of testifiers.
Right.
But if memory serves me correctly, some of those folks might have or in the past have favored single payer, but they stayed on message and talked about supporting the Affordable Care Act for fear that if they raise the spectrum of single payer, it would strengthen the opposition.
Is this an instance of not letting the perfect destroy the good, the perfect being single payer and the good being ACA?
You could structure it that way. We're dancing around this a little bit. Let me just respond directly. My own personal thinking about this has evolved, and I'm moving more and more towards being in favor of single payer with one residual concern. Right now, single payer providers, like in Great Britain, have to compare themselves with other countries. And if the United States goes that way, what will we compare ourselves to? And will there be a race to the bottom? Will it be just another budgetary item that has to be cut back every time the Republicans want to save a few bucks and spend it on defense instead of on social welfare programs? That's the only residual concern I have about our moving to single payer. Otherwise, I would be in favor of it.
Given the definite political makeup of the current Supreme Court, given the fact that also that there are legal precedents in place that would seem to indicate that this should pass muster as constitutional. But given that political makeup, I think about Citizens United ruling that was just obscene in saying that corporations had a freedom of speech to the extent of unfettered contribution secret. Given all this, what do you see as the possible outcome of this hearing?
I'll share with you that a year ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would have quoted the conventional wisdom inside the Beltway here in Washington that under any other Supreme Court, it's possible that this law would pass constitutional muster. But under the present one, it's definitely 5-4 against. However, there's been more scholarship and more constitutional authorities have been reading the prior decisions of these same nine justices, the opinions they've written in their own writings from the past. Mm-hmm. And now I am much more hopeful. I'm reading suggestions that it may go 7-2 in favor. There was one earlier today that was an authoritative opinion that it would go 8-1 in favor, with Thomas being the only
Thomas
holdout.
Thomas being the one who would hold out. Sure.
Consistent man.
Consistent. Dr. Hill, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on, and thank you for your attention to this issue.
It's fascinating to me for a number of reasons, and not the least of which, I'm entering that cohort now that relies on Medicare, although I don't. I have private insurance through my union, so I haven't gotten into it yet, even though I'm now eligible. But it's a fascinating topic to me. I hope this country can move toward comprehensive medical care for everybody. Dr. Hill, thank you very much for
being
here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Take care. All right, we'll be back momentarily. Stay with us as we continue discussion with our guests from Washington, D.C. regarding the ACA. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It's about 10 minutes before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Jeannie Aguilar. Her message, let's put unity back into community. Our next guest from Washington is Kathleen Stahl. She is the Director of Health Policy at Families USA. It's, of course, the national nonprofit organization that's dedicated to the achievement of high-quality, affordable health care for all Americans. And in this position, Kathleen Stahl oversees the organization's formulation of health policy positions and the analysis of specific health care proposals. She also oversees the delivery of technical assistance to state advocates and state legislators on health policy and programs. It doesn't sound like too easy a job, Kathleen, given the political atmosphere in this country.
Well, that's a good point. I am a Jill of all trades in the world of fighting for affordable health care for everyone, and it's a really difficult environment out in the states and here in Washington, D.C. I've been doing this work for about 30 years. Your listeners can't see my lovely gray hair, but this work will give you gray hair. But I have never seen such a partisan environment in which to work, and particularly mm-hmm. around health care issues. One of the things that strikes me is the Affordable Care Act is built on a foundation of some concepts that have been supported historically by Republicans.
Some of them initiated by Republicans.
Absolutely. Right. The concept of a subsidy delivered through a refundable premium tax credit, which will go into place in 2014, very robust help to people, middle-class families, so they can afford to purchase insurance, was originally a President George Bush initiative. He mm-hmm. put it on the table. Yet now we see Republicans opposing what they have labeled Obamacare, and I think that label tells you where the opposition is coming from. Mm-hmm. It has become all about electoral politics, all about who's going to control the White House, and not about what's good for people. And the idea that the Affordable Care Act is a government takeover is simply false.
It's insane.
It's
false. Yeah. You just made a very salient point to me, and that is that healthcare has been declared the battle zone, and I don't get this. I don't understand why the right wing has said we're going to use the issue of healthcare to divide the country. I can see using the issue of American interventions in foreign countries, or the issue of a tax policy, or some other issue. But dear God, at some point everybody is going to go to a doctor. At some point everybody is going to take medication. At some point everybody's going to have to pay their bill. Why this? Is it because there's so much fear and uncertainty in the health field that it's easily exploitable by the right wing?
Well, you know, I think when you look at a rural community where you see a strong influx of Republican voters, and you see someone in that community, a family that doesn't have insurance and a child that has a serious condition, the community will rally around that family with jars mm-hmm. at the grocery checkout line. But when you try to talk to them about the Affordable Care Act, they just don't realize that this law will help that very same family, mm-hmm. that it actually will provide a solution to those families in their own community. So part of what's going on is people just don't understand what the Affordable Care Act does. And the opposition that are politically motivated, that are about election politics, are spending a lot of money to confuse people right now. You know, I think we have to really work hard to make our case without having access to the same sort of resources to run paid advertising by being out in communities and pointing out that this family will be helped.
Mm-hmm. You know, you bring up something that has always just knifed me right in the heart, to see those collection cans for someone who's grievously ill, usually a kid, on a counter at a convenience store or a counter in a gas station, and you know it's a community rallying to try to help somebody, and you also know that there is no way that they're going to raise the $80,000 needed for a liver transplant or what have you, and it's astonishing to me that a can on the counter somehow, well, I appreciate the community aspect of that, that the can on the counter is seen as a way to provide health care instead of providing it legislatively for all Americans. That to me is just madness. I can't get away from the insanity of that.
Well, one of the things I see going on is that a very small minority of people who have religious conviction and faith are raising very loud voices in opposition to the Affordable Care Act. But they're a very, very small part of the faith community that I know, mm-hmm. of the people who are good church-going Christians in my neighborhood. I live in West Virginia mm-hmm. on the weekends. Keeps my sanity working here in D.C. Those folks want and feel a moral obligation to help their neighbors, and they need to understand the Affordable Care Act is a tool mm-hmm. to help all of us help our neighbor, so that when that family that doesn't have insurance goes to the doctors, and when they go to the hospital, instead of sort of randomly having our insurance premiums go up in a cost shift way or putting out a jar at the quick stop, that what will happen is that family will have insurance and we'll all mm-hmm. be part of the same system mm-hmm. that covers our risks. And any of us could benefit, any of us, from that system mm-hmm. at any given time. We all have insurance and we all have peace of mind and health security. But if some of us are outside the pool, then the system starts to fall apart.
Right, and those people are abandoned. We only have about a minute left here, but you know, you bring up the religious aspect, and I think it's appropriate to bring it up. So what has been puzzling to me, and I've said this to a couple other guests, is how many people who are professed followers of Jesus and don't respect he had very few admonitions to people, but one of them was to care for the sick, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit people in prison. And to me, that's a very elemental message. And why there are so many people, supposedly, of the Christian faith who are working against that very directive is beyond me.
Well, I think, you know, we're here in the Methodist building today,
right,
next door to the Supreme Court, in order to broadcast from different talk shows like yours. And one of the booklets that's lying in the chapel here of the Methodist building is called Social Principles of a Christian Family. And in it, it describes caring for those who don't have as much as you. Making sure that people have health care is one of the principles. And I think most of us who are of faith believe that caring for those less fortunate is part of what we stand for.
I hope. Kathleen Stoll, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. All right. Stay with us, Truth Seekers. More from Washington, D.C. regarding the Affordable Care Act. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Malloy Program, coming to you from Washington, D.C., not far from the Supreme Court, on Tuesday, where the Supreme Court is hearing arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act. This hour is being sponsored by Chris Siragusa. Thank you, Chris. Our next guest is Aaron Smith. He is a co-founder and executive director of an organization called the Young Invincibles. This organization represents the interests of 18 to 34-year-olds who are fast becoming a serious voice in public policy debates. Aaron is also a published writer on these issues. And right before we opened up the mics, I was talking with Aaron about the term "Young Invincibles." It has a certain cachet to it, but you're telling me it comes from.
So the term "Young Invincibles" actually is an insurance industry term.
Mm-hmm.
So young people are the most likely to be uninsured in the country. There's about 20 million uninsured young adults. And the insurance industry tried to come up with the theory of why are so many young people uninsured. And the theory they came up with was, well, young people think that they're invincible.
Right.
It's not because of cost or because they're unemployed or they don't have a job that offers benefits.
I'll never get sick. I'll never die.
They have this, that was their theory. And so what we did was we appropriated that term for our group and called ourselves Young Invincibles. And one of the things we said was no one is invincible without health care.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's true that young people tend to be healthier, the reality is most of us would buy insurance and we would, you know, take responsibility for that if it were affordable and if we had options.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why one of the reasons why we're so supportive of the healthcare laws, because for the first time my generation is going to have many more options to get affordable insurance than ever
mm-hmm.
before. And we, you know, already 2.5 million young people have exercised one of those options and stayed on their parents' plan at 26.
Right.
But by 2014, there's an additional 17 million who could actually gain coverage.
Mm-hmm. So much of the discussion about healthcare is exactly as you pointed out, Aaron. It's about people who may be at that point in their lives where they're, if not confronting illness, confronting the possibility. And I can remember when I was invincible, and it doesn't seem like it was that long ago, frankly. But how do you educate young people who are naturally and probably it's probably a good thing, resistant to the idea of I might get sick, I might get killed in a car wreck or whatever. When I say it's probably a good idea, I think young people should be unfettered from those kinds of concerns. So how do you approach that group and say, look, you got to have the coverage anyway?
Well, we try to, you know, have really just honest conversations and say, okay, look in your family. Do you know someone who's gotten sick? Do you know someone who's gotten injured? Have you ever had to go to the emergency room? You know, young people actually go to the emergency room more than any age group under 75.
Really?
Yeah, we get injured. We get sick. There's something happens. I remember when I graduated from college, I wasn't insured, and I went to the emergency room because I hurt my foot. It wasn't a big thing, but I remember having to pay all that money out of pocket and thinking to myself, you know, that's, you know, there's something wrong with this system. And, you know, having insurance really pays off. That's the sort of the message we try to convey. But for the most part, when we tell young people sort of about the options that they're going to have, they're very, I mean, they're very excited about it because they want to take responsibility. It's just, it's the same thing with living at home with your parents.
Right.
Nobody wants to live at home with their parents. You know, everyone wants to be able to get covered and take care of themselves if they get sick. It's a cost issue, and we have to find ways to make it more affordable. But right now, actually, we're doing a national bus tour. So we're going all around the country. We're doing 18 states plus D.C., and we're having these kind of conversations with young people from all different backgrounds, in school, out of school. And one of the big topics is healthcare and why it's important, what the new law means, and just trying to inform as many people as we can about what actually is in the law, because there's a lot of confusion about that.
Right. Do you feel, and this is a genuine question, I don't want to give you a loaded question here, do you feel that the resistance that's out there by the political right to affordable health care for everybody, do you feel that that is influencing young people, or are younger people more able to separate the BS from the truth and say, yeah, okay, well, Rush Limbaugh says this, or this other character says that, that doesn't affect us?
Well, one of the things about young people when you go out and talk to them is they're not as partisan. They're not as much into the Democrats versus Republicans, but there are definitely issues that unite us, young people, in a way. And I think this issue of, for example, Rush Limbaugh and the controversy over birth control, for young people, it's really not that much of a controversy.
Right.
You know, this is an issue that, particularly for young women, is just so widespread.
Right.
It's one of their biggest health care costs, the one that they everyone knows that they need to get, and it's a real expense. And so it's just widely popular. It's not really, it's something that's actually gotten a lot of young people excited, and we're looking out in front of the Supreme Court. Many of these are, you know, young women who are have gotten really engaged in part because of that debate, and are starting to get even more involved in talking about why this law is so important. Because it's, while birth control is an important part of it, there's a lot more out there that obviously impacts women's health and all young people's health.
In your experience with your organization and the writing that you do, do you find that you have a receptive audience where it concerns not just lawmakers, but maybe opinion makers, people? I guess what I'm getting at, do you find that because young folks, where it concerns policy decisions, are usually left out of the loop, how are you being received on this particular issue?
Well, it is a challenge. I mean, you're absolutely right. And when we first got started, that was the reason we got started, because, you know, this is a population that is the largest group of uninsured, but yet people weren't even talking about it. It's even just getting young people to be part of the conversation is the first step.
Right.
Now, getting them to also talk about, you know, from a policy perspective and think about the ideas that young people have to offer, that is also a challenge. But we've actually gotten, I think partly because of the rule that lets you stay in your parents' plan at 26, there's a lot of interest out there around young people right now. They know it's one of the, you know, the key, young people in some ways are the linchpin of the whole healthcare law.
Right.
Right? They're what holds it all together. And so there's more interest than I've ever seen, which is great. And young people pick up on that when the folks in the media actually, you know, pay attention to.
Well, that's
what
the thing. There's a responsibility on the part of reporters or media, as I've talked about many times. The press is the only occupation that's given constitutional acknowledgement in the First Amendment. Not doctors, not lawyers, not farmers, but the press. And it was made very clear that it's necessary to have a press that will inform people in order to maintain a democratic republic, in order to maintain what we have here. Do you feel that media have failed in getting the message out the way it should be gotten out?
In a lot of cases, yes. I think many young people have turned to alternatives, sources of news, in part because the traditional media isn't necessarily covering the issues that, you know, we're here to talk about healthcare, but look at an issue like student debt. That is an issue that's been going on under the surface for years, and it hasn't gotten the attention. And just now, we're starting to see that issue really come into
because
the forefront.
Because it's risen to $1 trillion.
Exactly, and you're starting to see people really taking to the streets on it. Sometimes it takes that much, you know, youth to actually come out to the streets before the media actually pays attention. The same thing is true with healthcare. Young people have been going uninsured for decades with no one really paying much attention. And finally, this law is going to bring... You know, it's going to do something about it.
I hope that it's not demolished in these hearings. Aaron Smith, I have a feeling you're the co-founder and executive director of Young Invincibles. I have a feeling people are going to be hearing a lot from you and about you in the years to come. And I just want to thank you very much for taking time to sit and chat. I wish we had more time, but you know how these events work. Move them in, move them out. Thank you very
much. Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, take care.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Truth Seekers, we'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. More interviews coming from Washington, D.C., from near the Supreme Court building. It is 21 past the hour. Mike Malloy coming to you from near the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., as we interview just a whole lot of folks. We did yesterday and we are today. We're waiting for our next guest, Representative John Sarbanes. You know how politicians can be. He may or may not show up. As I look out the window here at the Methodist Center where Radio Row, so-called, has been set up to handle all these interviews, there's a huge contingent of teabaggers. Tara, sit down and chat with me for a second, because Tara Dactyl, who runs the RepublicanDirtyTricks.com website. Yeah, no, you're on. Just be about 2 or 3 inches away. Tara has been out there trying to interview some of these folks, the teabaggers. What are you getting?
Well, honestly, Mike, I feel bad for these people.
Back up.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
They are completely impervious to fact.
No, really?
Yeah, I mean, they seem completely pre-programmed with Fox News talking points.
Yeah.
So when you present, like, they're actually repeating the latest, the CBL just released a statement saying that, excuse me. I'm getting nervous now.
Oh, stop. Stop.
Calm down. That Obamacare will actually reduce the deficit by an extra $50 billion, more than they expected. And
what happens when you tell them that fact?
They repeat the lie that National Committee released.
Yeah.
So it's like, how can you actually argue with somebody that they actually believe that the lies are the truth, and you're telling them the truth, and you're lying to them?
Well, we're gonna wade into those folks here when this broadcast is over, before we head for the airport, because I just want to see what it's like to be in a group of Institutionalized maniacs, who are just out on the street without any walls or bars around them, because the shouting and the screaming out there, and again, Tara, everybody I've talked to so far on the program, the subtext has been, why is there so much resistance to this? Why? It is not the perfect. And I am not 100% in favor. I'm not even 50% in favor of this as a long-term solution, because it's not the Affordable Care Act. Single payer is the long-term solution.
Exactly.
We all know that. But if there is an intermediate step, this is probably the closest we're going to get to something that works. And yet, the resistance to this by just about everybody who represents their right is just astonishing to me.
Right. And the thing is, like, they're talking about freedom and, when you're...
The freedom to go bankrupt.
Right, the freedom to be ridden to the bank unmercifully by corporations. That's what that's what they've been programmed to think. That they, as FDR said, a necessitous man is not a free man. Mm-hmm. He was quoting, actually, somebody else, but I can't remember who it was. But, They think that they have been propagandized to think that freedom means that corporations can have absolutely no regulation, and that they are like they're left at the mercy of the corporate state. Like that, they prefer that more powerful entity. I mean, really, we're living in the new Gilded Age. So they are, and the other thing that we were talking about this yesterday, just you and I, that they are aligning themselves with, like, the founding fathers and freedom of, like, this is a new American revolution, whereas they are the heirs to the loyalists.
The Tories.
They are the Tories. The Tories were the ones that were loyal to the crown.
Right.
And they were resistant to change. They want everything to remain the way it is.
Well, when we go out there in a couple of minutes, I'm going to expect you to make sure I don't get in a fist fight. And don't get arrested. And if I do, please have your camera out like you always do.
I'll be right up on YouTube.
And record what happens. Because this is, this is a form of collective hysteria out there. And it's just unbelievable to see. All right, Tara, thanks. Appreciate you sitting down talking to Tara. She goes by the name Tara Dactyl, and her website is RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. If you haven't been there, you need to go. You've heard me talk about it many times, but RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Matter of fact, go there right now when you hear the program and take a look at what she's got up. Thanks, Tara.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, we'll just another few minutes here, and we are going to continue. Let me see, who comes up next? I think Spike Ward is our next guest. Our next guest, I think, is Spike Ward. And after that, one more guest, Chris Turner, a Florida activist with the National Women's Law Center. So a couple more guests before we complete these 2 days of interviews with folks here in D.C. about this very, very, very important issue. If I have to, and you know what's weird about this, Truth Seekers? I don't do guests, right? I don't do guests. And we've had a guest every 15 minutes or every segment for the past 2 days. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Did you wake up? Welcome back. It is 25 before the hour. I'm Mike Malloy. We're still coming to you from Washington, D.C., not far from the Supreme Court building, where the Affordable Care Act is being argued. in front of the Supreme Court. Our next guest is Dr. Donna Christensen. She is also Representative Donna Christensen from the U.S. Virgin Islands. In addition to that, she chairs the Health Brain Trust for the Congressional Black Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Congress. Dr. Christensen, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
To what extent does the Affordable Care Act impact people of color in this country?
Oh, greatly. First of all, I mean, if you look at African Americans, 21% of us are uninsured now. Hispanic Americans, maybe around 35% are uninsured. So right off the bat, to be able to get insurance is really critical for us. That provides access that, in many cases, we've never had other than going to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, that's never enough because we've been out of the healthcare mainstream for so long that what we did as a Congressional Black Caucus working with the Hispanic and Asian Caucus as well as the Progressive Caucus, we got together and we decided that in addition to insurance, we had to have health equity be a part of this bill. And we worked very hard with our leadership in the House and Senate and the White House to ensure that programs were included in here and that health disparity elimination was a key goal of all of the task forces, all of the research and everything that goes on in there. We looked at, we have provisions that would increase the diversity of the workforce and increase cultural competency in the workforce that exists. We have community health centers, which for many is their main source of care. We've expanded on that. We've created community health worker grants, community transformation grants that prepare our communities to be able to take advantage of all of the benefits of healthcare reform. We've increased offices of minority health in agencies that never had it. We elevated our center at NIH to an institute. And those are just, and we also require data collection in ways that was never collected before so that we can know where we are and monitor our progress as we go through this bill. But the insurance protections in and of themselves are important to us. Our children often have pre-existing diseases. Asthma is very high in communities of color. Many of our children are now finding that they have diabetes. Sickle cell, of course, is a problem in the African-American community. And in many cases, the parents could not get insurance for those children.
Right.
And so now they're able to do that. So it's critical. We have a lot of chronic diseases. So historically, disproportionately suffer from chronic diseases. So in 2014, those will not be a limitation or a prevention from us getting insurance as adults. And of course, Medicaid expansion is important to our communities because a lot of people of color do live in poor communities, and we need that help.
It must be, I'm trying to think of the right word, difficult, odd, a challenge, weird, to live in the American Virgins knowing that in the French Virgin Islands and the British Virgins, there is health care for everybody.
There absolutely is. And I mean, if you, even, you know, I do a lot of work in HIV and AIDS. If a person comes from Haiti to St. Martin, they're going to get total health care coverage. Everything's going to be taken care of. We work very hard on improving the situation for the territories in terms of Medicaid and in health insurance area.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of the insurance protections that every American has. Our Medicaid has always been capped, but we have a tremendous increase in the amount of Medicaid dollars available to the territories, and we've something we fought very hard for. And also, we have the ability to set up an exchange either by ourselves or a regional exchange with a state or another territory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very important even to Americans that people sometimes don't see who live in the territories, two in the Atlantic and three in the Pacific.
How available is health care in, as you point out, the American territories, whether it is Atlantic or Pacific, how available is health care, just generally speaking?
Basic health care is pretty much available in the territories, but if you have to deal with specialty care, a lot of times we do have to travel for the more specific areas. So we travel in the Virgin Islands to Puerto Rico, where there's much more higher levels of care available, sometimes to Miami, depending on what the situation is. And for the Pacific, sometimes they have to go as far as Hawaii, and they're really far away to really get some of the tertiary, what we would call tertiary levels of care, the really high specializations.
Dr. Christensen, I have asked so many of the people that I've talked with over the past 2 days who have sat in your chair as a guest for a few minutes, why, and I want to ask you, why this resistance exists in the on the part of the political right in this country when it makes no logical sense, at least not to me, that it's not seen that health care for everybody benefits everybody.
I wish I could I wish I could give you a good explanation because I don't understand it myself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Republicans really are driven by things that are, they support things that are market driven. I mean, that's just the way they are. And why they can't understand it, healthcare is a bit different than most things that you purchase.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, it's been very clear that no matter what President Obama has sought to do, they're going to oppose it.
Yeah.
And they've done, unfortunately, a really good job of distorting what this bill is about.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not done as good a job in telling the truth about the bill. And so people are saying, you know, keep your hands off my health care, and they got Medicare. People who are uninsured and would benefit, are already benefiting, can't see beyond the rhetoric to the benefits that they're being provided. They also have created sort of a wedge between those who have insurance and those who don't have insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have insurance already should realize that this makes their insurance more secure. Nobody mm-hmm. can drop them just because they get sick. They have no lifetime limits. There are no annual caps. Preventive care is available for free. So those people who have insurance, this is not taking away anything from them, as people would have them believe. It is making their insurance more secure and giving them more benefits mm-hmm. in the insurance that they do have.
Is there an overriding health issue in the American Virgin Islands that would be different from health issues in this country?
No. Diabetes, hypertension,
mm-hmm.
chronic renal disease. We have a mostly black and Hispanic community, and if you go in any community like this, you're going to find some of the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
So heart disease, AIDS, all of it.
How do the citizens that you represent, what is their level of awareness of the criticality of this issue? Most Americans on the mainland, I think, inundated with facts about this and lies about this. How are people aware of it in the Virgin Islands?
Well, we've done our best to try to make people aware. I visited senior centers to make sure that they understand how important the mm-hmm. changes that what we've done for Medicare, in particular since they keep hearing that we've taken $500 billion out of Medicare, when what we really did was we saved what was being lost from waste, fraud, and abuse, and also equalized the payments to providers, and
mm-hmm.
then strengthen Medicare by lengthening the time of its solvency by 8 years, closing the donut hole. So I've gone out to senior centers and explained that. I've been on radio. And we also put together, my government has put together a healthcare task force that has also been very active in spreading the information about what good this bill is doing. And then we've been on radio. I got a chance to go to the Supreme Court yesterday. I'm missing the big argument today, but I got to go yesterday and reported back home on several of our radio stations about what was happening.
You were in there. You witnessed yesterday's testimony. Did you get any sense from these justices of how they are listening?
Oh, they are listening. They're listening. They have all of the cases right at their fingertips that might have relevance to this one, and they are questioning, and they're very, very active and actively involved. But I think, you know, yesterday's argument was about whether the case could be heard by the Supreme Court or not. Was the anti-injunction act,
mm-hmm.
would that apply?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way that they were speaking, they're very much seemed to think that they needed to be in, that this is a case that ought to be heard by the Supreme Court. So I think to that extent that that may be one hurdle over. And I'm not a lawyer, obviously. I'm a doctor. And my father used to tell me, as a lawyer, I make a good doctor. But talking to some of my lawyer colleagues, they feel that the precedent's already been there, that the Supreme Court has really upheld the authority of Congress to regulate commerce. To me, it's really clear. The other side talks about inactivity. We're not talking about inactivity here. We're talking about everybody participates in the healthcare market in one way or another. They're in it.
They're already in it. It depends on how we're going to take care
of
it.
And so we have Congress has the authority to regulate it.
And
there's a compelling government interest here because of the cost and what it's the skyrocketing costs of healthcare that is unsustainable.
Dr. Christensen, I have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with
me.
Thank
you.
And you live in a beautiful part of the world. Take care.
Thank you.
All right.
You too. Bye.
We'll be back. Stay with us, Truth Seekers. I'm Mike Molloy. It is 10 minutes before the hour, and our last guest in this two-day odyssey at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., is Chris Turner. She is a Florida activist with the National Women's Law Center. She was treated with precautionary anti-HIV drugs after being raped and then excluded from coverage because using HIV medications is, surprise, surprise, considered a pre-existing condition. Under the health care law, the ACA, starting in 2014, Chris and millions of other people with every imaginable health condition can never again be excluded from coverage. Chris, your story is particularly, on the one hand, tragic, violent, and poignant. How does ACA directly affect women, not necessarily who have gone through the trauma you went through, but women in general? I've asked several guests this, but I want to get your perspective, too.
Well, my perspective is, first of all, I'm a health insurance agent. And being a health insurance agent, I didn't realize that being a rape victim or anyone with domestic violence would be considered a pre-existing condition.
That's so bizarre.
It really, really is. And with ACA, with the ACA Act, it's going to prevent anybody from being denied coverage for having a pre-existing condition. And, you know, people with pre-existing conditions, they need the insurance the most, you know. So they're going to make sure that nobody is ever denied coverage for having a pre-existing condition again. And I think that's extremely important.
Given the ridiculous and, to me, obscene controversy that was raised over the past couple of weeks about Ms. Fluke and how that was treated by right-wing talk radio, given that hysteria, do you think that ultimately, ultimately the unintended effect of that may have been to raise some consciousness in this country about how the right wing perceives women's health?
I really hope that the perception comes around that everyone needs and deserves health insurance. And I really don't think that people are thinking about that right now. You know, and that's the most important part. Everyone needs and deserves health insurance, especially people with pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's a travesty that they can't get coverage right now. And ultimately, the taxpayers and the opposers are the ones that are going to end up paying for it.
Right.
So I don't understand that part.
I can't think of anything about the human condition that is not a pre-existing condition. But the way it's defined by insurance companies, I think most of us understand that the function of a health insurance company is not to take care of you. It's to make a profit.
Absolutely.
And if in the process you get taken care of, oops, surprise, surprise. So the ACA, it tries to soften those edges a bit, but as far as I'm concerned, it's not quite there. What we need in this country is single payer.
Absolutely.
And do you agree with that as
yes.
part of the National Women's Law Center?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That the way to go is single payer.
Yes.
What do you think is delaying that?
I think it's your Tea Party. I think it's the Republicans that don't understand. And again, I don't think what they don't understand is they're picking up the bill for all the people that are uninsured right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really don't understand their opposition in that.
The I've had several guests on who have pointed out to me that health care costs for women exceed health care costs for men.
Absolutely.
Especially in certain age demographics.
Absolutely.
And the fact that that is not acknowledged in terms of medical care delivery in this country seems to me to be a situation that most women should be just raising pure, unadulterated hell about.
Yeah, women pay more than $1 billion more than men.
Mm-hmm.
How is that? That's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think people understand that, and they really need to.
What do you think it'll take to, if not convince the right-wing crazies in this country that they exist in some past that it is not going to continue, that they're standing in the way of progress? What's it going to take?
I think it's really going to take education on their part, because I really feel like they're coming from an ignorant level, and I don't know of a better word to say that, but it's really going to take education. Or if something like this travesty happens in their family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And God forbid, I don't want that to happen, but if they do go through things like I went through and some of these other women that spoke today, then they're going to rethink it. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to be like, okay. Or when their insurance gets jacked up, okay, and they don't realize because of certain situations or because one of their family members gets sick and then their premiums go sky high, you know, I just think it's education. And hopefully not the same thing that happens to their family.
Yeah. I wish I had the ear of right-wingers so I could just say to them, you know, why don't you join the human race?
Exactly.
Why don't you join efforts in this country to provide health care for everybody on an equitable basis? I'm sure you might feel
and
that way sometimes, too.
Be treated equally.
Yeah.
Men and women.
Right.
Be treated, all Americans, to
right.
be treated equally.
What an idea.
Right?
You know, what an idea.
And it's so simple.
Somebody ought to write it down.
And it's so simple.
Right. I hear you. All right, Chris Turner, thank you very much. Chris Turner with the National Women's Law Center, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Take care. All right. We are just about finished this two-day sojourn. Tara and I are now going to head across the street into this melee of right-wingers and see if we can start some trouble. Just kidding. Malloy says he's going to go to the teabaggers and start trouble. Well, you never know, you know? All right, thanks a lot for tuning in. I appreciate it. And also, one more time, this last hour was sponsored by Chris Siragusa. Thanks, Chris. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Nature Seekers might.